Morning. We're delighted to welcome everyone here, but especially our students from Michicut High School. Would they please stand? Wow, another big group. Good seeing you. Please be seated. We had your colleagues at the first oral argument, and as the students know, the students are here with a program sponsored by the State Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The program is called Court with Class. It's a national award-winning program whereby students are invited to come to the oral argument. They're given copies of the brief, and they may engage in discussion or activities relating to the case that they're about to hear. As part of that program, the students also meet with a justice at lunchtime, right after this case. They discuss the procedures of the court in taking and deciding cases, not the substantive issues involved in the cases that we have heard. Everyone is welcome to attend that noon session. If anyone here wants a summary of the case that you're about to hear, if you'd raise your right hand, the marshal has such a summary. It's easier to listen to an oral argument if you know a bit more about it. Okay, thank you. Let me introduce the court to you before we proceed with calling the case. On my far right is Justice Patience Robinsack. To her left is Justice Pat Crooks. And Justice Crooks is the justice with whom you'll meet after this case is heard. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I will call 05AP0077, Shannon E.T. versus Alicia M. V.M., Moses Joseph Zimmerman representing Shannon E.T. Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Moses Joseph Zimmerman, and I represent Shannon E.T., the appellant and petitioner in this case. Shannon is the father of a stillborn child, Caden, who was killed when his mother, Alicia, was involved in a motor vehicle accident. And the question before this court is, by what means can Shannon establish his parentage of Caden to maintain a wrongful death action pending in Wood County? The Wood County Trial Court insisted that parentage be established under the paternity statute, which resulted in a petition or a motion being filed in Monroe County. The trial court in Monroe County determined that there was no cause of action because the baby was stillborn.
Let me ask you about the facts, because I was somewhat troubled by this. I think from the order in the record, it's clear that the judge in Wood County wanted paternity established. I'm not sure it's clear in the record that he wanted it established in Monroe County by a particular procedure. I'm not sure the record reflects that. You may know more about it than the record reflects, but I'm not sure the record reflects.
Frankly, Justice Butler, I don't know anything outside of the record.
All right.
Okay. And as you indicate, I believe the order is two sentences, and it says that paternity must be established and that the proceedings are stayed. So I take it from that he was not, the judge was not going to establish paternity in his court for whatever reason. It may be that there were other issues besides just establishing parentage, right? But we don't know because, as you say, the record consists of one order, I believe two sentences. But as you know, under the paternity statute, there is the different venue. And so a paternity action was started for the sole purpose of establishing Shannon's parentage of Caden.
Mr. Zimmerman, yes. Is the question of whether Shannon is or is not the father of the deceased a question of fact or a question of law?
I believe it's a question of fact because the statute, the genetic test and civil action statute, which is section 885.23 of the statutes, says that if there is an issue regarding parentage, that the court shall order genetic testing. And if the party refuses, then what happens is there's an adverse inference from that. So it's an evidentiary rule, and I believe then it goes to the jury as a question of fact.
I guess what's troubling me is the case that's not here, and that's the wrongful death action, because it's my understanding that the judge said hold up on the wrongful death action until paternity has been established. And what's troubling me is why shouldn't paternity be established as part of the wrongful death action? In other words, if you recover, you recover because you've established that you were indeed the father of the deceased. I don't understand whether or not Judge Zappin was requiring a separate action. It appears that he was, but I'm troubled by that. Can you address that?
Right. I agree with what everything you just said. Unfortunately, the only part of the record I know is the record that was submitted to the Court of Appeals. And so I don't know what kind of hearing was on the record or off the record that resulted in this order. But I take it from the order that Judge Zappin was not going to establish paternity in his court.
He wasn't going to allow the jury, as an example, to find whether or not this claim of Shannon was.
It could be that he was not aware of the statute, the genetic testing statute in civil actions, or it could be that he thought that there were other issues relating to paternity which were better suited for the paternity action. Now, I fully understand that the wrongful death case is not before this court, but as pointed out by the Court of Appeals, these are related cases involving related statutes, and the controversy and issue really is the wrongful death case. And so that's really the lawsuit. Unfortunately, the way the case has come down, my client is caught in limbo. He really doesn't know where to turn. The Court of Appeals has told him that he does not have a claim under the paternity statute, but it doesn't really direct or give any guidance as to whether or not he can go back to Judge Zappin now and say, we must do it in your court. And this is the guidance that we are looking for from this court.
Well, now, 76701 says that the circuit courts have jurisdiction of all actions affecting the family. All actions affecting the family shall be commenced and conducted and orders and judgments enforced according to these statutes in respect to actions in circuit court and as far as applicable, except as provided in this chapter. So 76702 says, look, 767 covers family. What's an action dealing with family? And that includes paternity. And then 76745 deals with paternity. So my question is, can you determine, and it's a follow-up to Justice Crooks' question, can you determine paternity outside of 767 in light of what I just read to you about 767?
Well, interestingly enough, if you look at 885.23, it makes direct express reference to 767.48, which is under the paternity statute.
That's right.
So these are related statutes. It seems to say you can go either way.
Well, go ahead.
As I read it, I mean, that's when I was preparing for the case, I guess I read it a couple of times, but didn't pick up in 885.23 shall be receivable as evidence. So I'm looking at 885.23, and it seems to me that when parentage is an issue, the court shall direct any party to the action involved in the controversy to submit to a genetic test under 76748. And let's say that genetic test comes back, as some of these do, 99.9% of probability or something like that. You know, so most of us would say, ooh, you know, this person's the parent. But the statute goes on to say the results of the test shall be receivable as evidence in any case where exclusion from parenthood is established or where a probability of parentage is shown to exist. So that shall be admissible or shall be receivable as evidence sounds to me like that the determination of, I don't know what it sounds like. I mean, you get the test results under and the procedure of 76748, but there's no finding of paternity per se. Rather, the test results are taken back and admitted as evidence in the wrongful death. Do you think I'm right, or do you think I'm wrong on that?
Well, I think you're putting your finger on the problem that Judge Zappin may have had in reading the statute. It seems to say that the genetic test shall be under 767.48, which is the paternity statute. And that may have misled him into thinking that he could not decide it in his court. And I read it to mean that the opposite. I read it to mean that the genetic test should be conducted in the wrongful death action. It says shall be. It's not discretionary. It's mandatory. And then the results are submitted as evidence.
Yeah, but you know, 885 is a procedural statute, an evidentiary statute, not a court jurisdiction and substantive statute. 767, dealing with paternity, is the substantive statute of how you deal with paternity, which is a family. I mean, that's one interpretation.
Right. But the question is, does that mean that exclusive jurisdiction lies with the paternity statute? Mm-hmm. Or like in Milwaukee County, they have, I believe, courts dedicated to family matters. But I don't think that's the case in Wood County or Monroe County.
It seems to me odd that the statute 885.23, in reference to 767, doesn't have a broader reference than to 48, which is specifically the test. You know, what's the procedure, and how do you pick the kind of genetic test, and blah, blah, blah. It could have made reference to 767.45, for instance, which is a determination of paternity. But it doesn't seem to be talking. It doesn't say paternity shall be determined under 767.45. It says test shall be conducted under 48.
I think because the issues are narrower in the wrongful death case, the issue really is one, is he the father? Is he the biological father of the stillborn child? There are no other issues that may come up as a result of that decision. For example, if there are potential liabilities as the father, those issues are not decided in that case. So it's very specific to genetic testing. What we're talking here about is genetic testing to prove parentage, nothing more. Now, Shannon's position is that he's entitled to proceed under either 885.23 or under 764.48. The preferred method of dealing with it would be to do it within the wrongful death case. However, because of the rulings of the trial court, that was not possible. And, of course, that was not an appealable order. They would have had to do some kind of mandamus.
And am I correct that what's being sought here, because I'm not sure it was really clear to me, what's being sought here is, in fact, testing and not some other application of 767 to establish paternity?
What we're talking about here is a wrongful death action wherein the plaintiff is required to establish that he is the father of the child.
Right.
885.23 provides a procedure for doing this. However, that statute makes specific reference to the paternity statute, saying that's the kind of genetic testing we're talking about.
That deals with genetic testing. I guess my question goes as to whether under, because you brought this as a 767 action, whether your intent is to go for the genetic testing, or are you looking at, for example, establishing paternity by acknowledgement or by some other means provided by statute?
Unfortunately, acknowledgement is not possible in this case. I mean, it would have been great if there was an acknowledgement. That would solve everybody's problem. But as you know, or the record shows that Alicia is represented by guardians or her parents because she is incompetent, legally incompetent. Now, I understand that she suffered some kind of brain injury in the accident. So I don't know if the parents were asked to acknowledge or if they're even able to acknowledge under these circumstances. So that's kind of a unique fact situation. We can't use acknowledgement. So we're back to genetic testing. Now, there's another problem with the genetic testing because the baby's been interned. Now, the record shows that there are tissue samples that were retained by the hospital. So there's at least the potential for genetic testing. But as you know, the statute 885.23 says if genetic testing is not possible, then there's an adverse inference. So it's not conclusive. It doesn't mean that there's no cause of action. The jury could still find for the plaintiff.
Because you're under 767 at the moment, would you expect that the court, the circuit court, would limit its findings of paternity only to the wrongful death? Or is it a general finding of paternity, which there are other instances where this may come into play, such as if there were medical expenses incurred by the mother, the family may want the father to pay for them, or any other issues.
I fully agree with you. There may be potential liabilities under 767, and Shannon recognizes that, and there are rights and obligations that come from a finding under 767, and Shannon is willing to live with that. In fact, one of the problems with the Court of Appeals decision is that they did not find any potential liability here. They said, well, the only thing that we're here for is this wrongful death action. I submit that there are potential rights and obligations under 767 that would be binding on Shannon. And payment of hospital bills would be certainly one example. I think the Court of Appeals looked at this case too narrowly when it said that this is solely for the purpose of bringing a wrongful death action in another county. At the same time, they did acknowledge that these were related cases involving related statutes, but showing the height of judicial restraint, you refused to make any rulings that would be helpful in a wrongful death case.
Counselor, if you had your choice about what we were going to do with our decision, would you like us to rule that he can, A, go forward with the paternity action, or rule that 885.23 is appropriate to use and give that direction for how the case is to proceed?
Well, assuming that he can't have it both ways.
And that's true. It may be. Okay, go ahead.
For reasons of judicial economy and efficiency, we would prefer to proceed with the 767 action.
Why is that?
Because we're already in Monroe County Court. We've started the action there. Sending us back to Judge Sappin may be okay, but it seems to me the practical effect is that it would be better for the litigants in this case to go back to the paternity court. However, going beyond the litigants in this case as a matter of judicial policy, I would say that it would be better if this case were sent back to the trial court in the wrongful death action. So we keep everything in one court, in one action, in one judicial district, and so on and so forth. So that as a matter of judicial policy, I would say that 885 is the way to go.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Well, you're under 767.45. The following persons may bring an action, including declaratory judgment action, to determine paternity of a child. Is that where what you're under now?
Yes.
And so the problem is, what is a child?
Well, the trial court saw that as a problem and ruled that a stillbirth is not a child within the meaning of that statute. However, the Court of Appeals rejected that reasoning and did not rely on it. And what the Court of Appeals did was say that the statute is ambiguous in its context, in that the paternity statute contemplates a judgment that governs many, many different things. And this case, in their view, was strictly about a wrongful death. So they said, in the context, this statute doesn't apply. And that one reason it made that ruling is because they pointed out we have this other statute, 885.23, and that really was the one of the primary, there are two primary bases for their decision. One is legislative history, and the other is the existence of 885.23. That's the basis of their ruling.
You've made the argument here, but you didn't make it in your brief, and I'm wondering if that may have had something to do with the Court of Appeals' opinion, that 885.23 kicks you back to 767.48.
Yes.
So if you read that consistent with the rest of the chapter, where does that take you?
Well, it kind of takes you in a circle. And so, in a sense, this is the perfect case for this court, because
You think we're circular.
I think what's happened is that the rulings below are circular. That's what I think, and it's the unique role of this court now to guide the parties, and not just the parties, but, you know, future actions involving this kind of a fact situation.
I would have thought you would have said that the Court of Appeals decision would have to be an error looking in the context, because the context kicks you back to 767, and by its very nature, 885.23 says you apply the procedures in 767.48, and therefore 767.48 must contemplate the use of this for these purposes.
Well, I agree with you, and in fact, there's what I consider to be a corollary case decided by the Court of Appeals, which I believe they only cite in a footnote, but it's the Di Benedetto case, which is a probate case involving a deceased father and his children fighting over his estate. So they were trying to establish paternity for heirship reasons. But in that case, the ruling was that these issues could be determined under either 885.23 or the paternity statute in the probate proceeding. And I think that case is sort of the corollary to this fact situation. We don't have a deceased father, but we have a deceased child. So I think that these issues should be decided in one court, if possible.
The Kwaterski case, which is a 67 case, talks about the wrongful death statute and says a stillborn is a person.
Correct.
Within that statute. Narrow decision, right? Stillborn,
correct.
Okay. In Krasuki, a later case, in 97, the issue is what child means in the children's code. And there they say child means, does not mean fetus, a strong descent. One of the issues then is, are we in the children's code? No.
No.
In the family code.
Correct.
So Krasicki does not quite apply because you could have the same word defined in different statutes, right?
It's easily distinguishable because, as you say, it's a children code involved the custody issue and taking custody over the child when the child has still not been born.
Okay. And Kwaterski does not apply because if you can get paternity, then you're in under person, so that's not an issue.
Right.
You know, let me put it as a question. Is there an elephant in this room
that nobody is really talking about, but really may be underlying why we will or will not, or a court will or will not define a fetus, a viable fetus, or a stillborn as a child?
Well, the answer is it's a loaded issue.
Okay, so it's a loaded shotgun, not an elephant. And what is that elephant or loaded shotgun?
Well, I think...
Let's put it out on the table. It just makes everything easier to deal with, in my opinion.
Right. It's our position, of course, that a viable fetus is a child.
And but I think you have that to do that to get under 767, but what's the problem? Okay.
And I don't think there is a problem with this Court saying that. I do
well,
not.
I think that maybe, and I don't know because I haven't thought it through, that there may be concerns here that when you define a stillborn as a child, or you start defining viable fetus as a child under 767, and I haven't gone through the statute to see where else the word child is used, that you're going to get into other issues like abortion.
Well, it's a genuine concern. I think that's a concern that we all recognize. And that may be one reason to stay under 885.23.
That's narrower if you'd
which
go under
narrower,
that
yes.
Avoid some of the other questions.
And
are there any other issues other than abortion that you think are lurking here?
Well, truthfully, I've not thought about those potential issues, but there always are. I mean, the fact that I can't think of them doesn't mean there aren't any. But certainly, I would say that the hot topic issue of what is a child and what isn't a child, what is a viable fetus a child, and so on and so forth, what is viability, is it 27 weeks, is it 28 weeks, those are all issues in flux. And
usually in the abortion circumstance.
Right. But the abortion is the big, big hot topic issue. And in terms of how this affects judicial policy relating to this case, I wish I could be more helpful, but I can't. Because I haven't really thought about it enough. But I recognize that it's there.
Chief, if I may,
Justice Butler,
we might as well load the other barrel of that shotgun.
Yeah.
Is there another underlying issue here that may be lurking in the background that deals with the rights of unwed fathers, whether it be a child who's born or whether it be a fetus, and whether or not they should be able to recover under these circumstances?
Well, as you know, the paternity statute was amended, I believe it was 1997 legislative action in response to a Supreme Court case addressing the rights of unmarried fathers. So one of the purposes of this statute is to give unmarried fathers the right to establish their paternity of the child. And so the Court of Appeals, of course, has that very neatly pointed out, but seem to ignore it in their ruling. You know,
yeah.
One of the purposes is to protect the rights of unmarried fathers. Mm-hmm. Fathers, and this is exactly what we're talking about in the wrongful death case. It's the father's right to bring this action under Wisconsin law. So he should have the right to use that statute. You know, and the fact that it's for the purposes of a wrongful death action is a non sequitur to me. I see my time has expired. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Michael J. Roman, representing Alicia M. VM, is individually and by her guardians, Patricia and Brian VM. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Michael Roman. I'm with the Zalewski, Klinner & Kramer Law Firm in Wausau, and I represent the respondents, Alicia Brian, and Patricia. Patricia and Brian are also here in the courtroom with me personally. This case is not a wrongful death action. The Court of Appeals has not foreclosed Shannon from pursuing his pending wrongful death action in Wood County. Accordingly, this appeal only involves a side issue to that pending case. With all due respect to the elephant and the shotgun analogy, does not implicate any of the constitutional issues, nor does it raise broader issues concerning the rights of putative fathers.
Well, Mr. Roman, what does a putative father do when confronted with in a wrongful death action with a court that, and all we have is the order, that stays the proceeding pending the determination of paternity? How is a putative father to proceed at that point?
I think that's, you've latched onto one of the issues in this case, and it's sort of underlying a lot of the problems that you have, even issuing a ruling here, because you're dealing with a case and an order that's not really before the court. It was never appealed. There could have been a petition for leave to appeal filing from that decision. It's our position that it was a choice made by Shannon in this case to seek a separate paternity action. And in this case, just to be clear with some of your other questions, it wasn't just a genetic testing, for instance. It was a demand for a jury trial. A jury trial presumably demands the proof that is set forth in the paternity statutes. I do think that that's one of the problems here, and it seems to be the way I view it, the Court of Appeals decision didn't foreclose Shannon from being able to proceed in his wrongful death action. If the Supreme Court were to affirm the Court of Appeals decision, he can very well likely go back to the Court of Appeals, to the trial court in Wood County and say, look, this issue was brought up, 885-23. I know the court doesn't have the record of what occurred in that case. I don't believe it was ever addressed or raised in that case at the point that the stay was in place. As far as I'm concerned, the order reflects there's a stay waiting for some determination. I believe if the court looks to my transcript of the trial court hearing, there is a reference that I make in the transcript. I believe it's on page 21. Where I basically state that I believe it could be stipulated. We had raised there was no standing in that case to pursue the claim at that point, and the court stayed the hearing, that action pending, whether this issue would be resolved perhaps in a separate paternity action filed there, or as the attorney at that time for Shannon chose to do, or file it in a different county. That's about it that we have for the record of what occurred in Wood County. I do think it would be more appropriate, and I think that's what the Court of Appeals was attempting to do in this case, is to limit its holding to the precise issue that was before the court in the paternity case here. We have a stillborn infant. The only purpose that's set forth in the petition for bringing the action, contrary to the suggestions of counsel, is for the sole purpose of the paternity determination so that he can then use it in the wrongful death case. But I think it would be more appropriate, and I think that's what the Court of Appeals was trying to do, is limit our reaction or our holding to this specific issue here based on the limited facts that we have, which are all those that are set forth in the paternity petition. Those are undisputed at this point. There's no answer. There hasn't been any further evidentiary or discovery that's allowed under the paternity statute or anything like that.
Counselor, you're opposing the determination of paternity. Why?
Well, my clients believe that it's adverse to Alicia at this point. I believe there was an attempt, and I don't know if it's in the record, but at one point there was discovery requests for admission served on all of the respondents in this case. They could not affirm or deny the paternity of of the stillborn in this case based on their knowledge. Alicia obviously can't based on her condition. So
I understand the evidentiary problems given her injuries, but my question is still, why? Why is Alicia, through her guardians, opposing a determination of paternity?
Well, I think one of the reasons is, while she is not personally being sued in the wrongful death action, her actions or her alleged negligence is being called into question for the death of the stillborn. So she has very personal interests in this. So that's the bottom line. This is more personal than just a procedural back and forth, that there are real issues that come apart.
So she's named as a defendant in the wrongful death action?
She is not.
She's not.
She's named as a plaintiff?
No,
she is not a party. The court is aware there was a covenant not to sue that was signed. The covenant not to sue or that was signed by Shannon. And that, quite frankly, may be one of the other reasons why we're here in a different court, because Shannon signed a covenant not to sue. Does Alicia have to be a party in the wrongful death action if 885.23 is going to be applied? Those are all issues that may be before the court, again, depending on how it resolves the case here. There are a lot of other factual issues that perhaps have to be developed a little bit in that case that Alicia and, I might say, other defendants, other parties in that case would certainly and should have the ability to weigh in on some of the issues that are being raised here. So I think that was one of the other concerns that the Court of Appeals had by not going further and mandating something in another.
Mr. Roman, do you think that the question of whether Shannon is or is not the father of the stillborn is a question of fact or a question of law?
I think it has to be an issue of fact, either under the paternity statutes or under the wrongful death action, because I think it's a I would argue in the wrongful death action you run into issues of perhaps standing. If you're not a father, how can you pursue a wrongful death action?
Sure.
So there it might be quasi-law legal, but it's still a factual. There's got to be a finding of some sort that there was a father, whether that's done in front of a jury or genetic testing. I do think it's an issue of fact. We haven't really talked about how the court...
Mr. Roman, I do have one additional question. You had mentioned at the beginning of your argument that it was not just about genetic testing. It was also about trial. Yet, as I read 885.23, that kicks you into the procedures in 767.48. And as I understand 767.48, that gets you to a trial as well. And so I guess my question is when we're dealing with this case, is this really just merely a case as you see it about venue, or is this something else? Because it would seem to me that if you've got this ancillary action that can be raised in a wrongful death action, and the statute, as the Court of Appeals said, takes you back through this procedure, that it's not a question of whether it can be done, it's where it's done. Am I reading that correctly?
Or how is it? I still think it's how is it done. I understand what you're saying, that it pulls it back
48 gives you the how.
It gives you the procedural how, the scientific basis.
Also the trial.
Correct. I'm thinking the trial issues. And all I can say when I said that they were seeking a jury trial, when the issue came up in this case, the judge obviously had some concerns about would there be even genetic testing available. I don't know if the judge was, and I'm talking about the trial court in the Monroe County case, had concerns about whether there was genetic material available for the 767 proceeding or whether he was wanted to preserve it for other reasons. Shannon's prior counsel said that it didn't matter if there was genetic materials. They were ready to proceed without that. Presumably in this case, and that makes it a little difficult, I think, for purposes of a paternity determination, you have a mother that's not able to testify one way or the other. You don't have genetic materials. You have a putative father who's claiming this. I think we even run into problems with some of the preliminary issues that have to be resolved as far as conception periods that are under the statutes. The paternity petition has a copy of an informal notice from the hospital that has the weight of the stillborn here, which is under the amount for the conceptual period. So you run into a whole host of problems as far as proof issues, I think, in this case, if the genetic material isn't available.
Counselor, I understood from opposing counsel that the hospital had saved tissue samples, so there could be genetic testing done, because when I read the briefs, I understand that the fetus's remains had already been interred and were not available for genetic testing. What's your position on that?
It's an informal, when the judge brought this issue up in the trial court in Monroe County, he'd say, look, what's the status? I want to make sure, because the judge knew this had the earmarks of the Supreme Court, I think, just because of the novel nature of it, he asked our office to inquire in it. We did contact the hospital. There is a reference, I believe it's record reference, around 37 and 38, a brief memo. It's not signed. It's not an affidavit from the nurse who was in charge of both the interment of fetal remains and the laboratory. There is some placental samples that were saved. I don't know the status of those, whether they can be used or not. When we reported that to Shannon's prior counsel, he stated that he had conferred with experts and that those would not be usable for genetic testing. Then, of course, we run into the problem with the interment issue. It's an unusual situation that they're not singularly interred. They're combined with others. So we might run into a whole host of problems if there's an exhumation order of having to contact parents across central Wisconsin to let them know that the remains of their infant would have to be exhumed. I mean, there are real problems that come up in this, and I don't think it was intended at any point that this would occur, but it's just the nature of the way the statutes have set up. Whether that could be usable, the placental tissue, I don't know the status. I'm not a DNA expert. Whether that's changed since this was 2004, I think that issue was brought up, and whether current counsel has a different opinion on that, I don't know.
But that's the only tissue samples you're aware of are placental?
That's what I'm aware of, yes.
Thank you.
If you were sitting on the court and your position prevailed, how would you write the opinion? What, if anything, would you change in the Court of Appeals?
Actually, as this case has proceeded through the trial court, we were the one that raised the issue of stillbirth versus live birth. I think that's one way the court could view it. I think the Court of Appeals did raise some issues and problems with that, and I think the Chief Justice has raised the issues as far as if we start looking at child and all these other things, does it have a problem? When it came to the Court of Appeals decision being released, I thought they did a very good job of analyzing how this, based on the specific facts here, looking at the overall structure, language, and history of the paternity statute. And I think that's a key here that we look at it. It's not just one statute. The focus seemed to be early on in this case just on 760.745 sub 1, which is who can bring a claim. The Court of Appeals went beyond this, said that doesn't really answer the question here. We have to go beyond that to look at the overall structure. And quite frankly, I think this case basically comes down to one of statutory construction involving an issue that I don't think was ever contemplated by the legislature and all their changes and manipulations to the paternity statutes since Kwiatkowski came down. I don't think this issue was ever even contemplated by them. So I think the Court of Appeals analyzing the particularly the legislative history, because I do think that was key, looking at all these changes and responses to the legislature based on U.S. Supreme Court cases dealing with the rights of fathers. There were problems with the statutes, prior to that. And you come down to this state leading, or one of the few states, or first states, I should say, to come down with Kwiatkowski talking about wrongful death for a viable fetus. I think looking at overall the structure of it, I would basically, if you could issue a decision, it would be very similar to what the Court of Appeals did.
If I can ask you about that, obviously you don't get to legislative history and extrinsic sources unless you have ambiguity. And as I understood the Court of Appeals opinion, you can't get ambiguity by merely looking at the words of the section in question. You have to do it in context. Now, when we're doing a contextual approach, are we limited to Chapter 767, or do we have to read the statutes in peri materia and look at the rest of the statutes, including the wrongful death statute?
Well, I think you first look at the statutes nearest and closest in relevance, and by relevance I mean that presumably are of the same topic. So if you're talking issues related to the family, I think you're going to look at Chapter 767. Paternity is down there, is in that section or chapter. I think that's going to be more compelling than a wholly different statute that may have had a different reason for being enacted. I think that's the court has stated that in the Krasicki case about just because it says it one chapter that's unrelated, it's hard to apply the same analysis or holding or conclusion, if you will, interpretation to another wholly unrelated. So I think 767 is the place to look. I think that's what the Court of Appeals did here. They looked at the structure. They looked at they sort of played off one of the things that the trial court found had a concern of as well, and was the main basis of the trial court, was the subsection 3 of 767.45 sub 3, which talks about action being stayed until after the birth. The trial court concluded, well, does that mean there's got to be a birth? Then it looked to, I think it's 767.51 sub 3, talking about what's going to be contained in the judgment on paternity. A lot of the things obviously had no applicability to stillborns, but it's mandatory. It says shall contain, so there was a problem there.
Well, I guess here's my question. If you take the stillbirth aspect out of this case, let's just remove that for a moment. Assume the child was born alive, and you have a wrongful death claim. A parent in a wrongful death action can bring a wrongful death action under the wrongful death statute, but in order to be able to bring the action, you have to be a parent, correct?
You have to have, under the wrongful death, you have to have standing as...
Exactly.
Right.
So in order to establish standing, you have to establish paternity. You have to show, unless you're, by operation of law, presumed to be the parent under the operative statutes, you have to establish paternity. So I guess my question is, does this then make this one of the related statutes that the Court of Appeals would have to look at in the determining how to apply 767.45?
I think the way you get to that is how the court looked at it. If we presume that Kwiatkowski set the standard for a viable fetus as the a right to recover under wrongful death, it wasn't for 14 years that the legislature put in place under 745 or 767.45 sub 1, the right of a putative father to bring a claim. You have 14 years there where presumably if 767 was the only way to do it, if we're talking to contest it, obviously you have acknowledgement and you have some other ways to get paternity. But if we're talking about a contested paternity, there was 14 years where technically if you didn't buy into what the Court of Appeals says here, that Section 885.23 was available, someone in Shannon's position wouldn't have been able to pursue it. Then you might have had a problem. I think the way the Court of Appeals analyzed that, looking at the legislative history, 885.23, where its predecessor has been in place, I think, since 1935. It's originally a blood testing statute. The changes to genetic testing, I think, were made in the mid-90s as technology has improved. Goes back a little bit to Justice Prosser's question. I think genetic testing is probably a preferable way now that we know it takes away the adversarial nature of a lot of paternity. The DNA says what it says, and unless you don't have it available, which may or may not occur in this case.
Counsel, you indicate Kwiatkowski set the standard, and the standard, as I understand it, is that a parent can bring a wrongful death action for the death of a viable fetus. Is that your understanding?
That's what I understand Kwiatkowski did.
Are you asserting that if parents are not married, that only the mother can bring the action?
No, I think Chang, I shouldn't say anything. I think Chang which was the 1994 case that the Supreme Court came off with. In that case, similar to the wrongful death action, you had I believe they were married couple.
So
but
if the petitioner here is declared the father, he can bring a wrongful death cause of action. Is that correct?
If there's an adjudication under 767, the court would allow the per yes, he would be able to bring a wrongful death action.
How, and you say 767, I see 8523, as we discussed earlier, refers to testing under 76748. How, if they did it wrong, how should it be done then that in an unwed situation and a viable fetus situation with a wrongful death cause of action, how, what should the procedure be that they should have followed?
I think the way, and it didn't really occur to me until after I read the Court of Appeals decision, I do think 885.23 is a preferable. It's raised as an issue if it's relevant in the wrongful death action, rather than pursuing it outside of that. If we're talking about a stillborn infant, when you deal with...
let me, if I may stop, you said is preferred. Well, that sounds to me like there are other ways of doing it. I mean,
well, there could be acknowledgement. Those statutes
where we have this kind of a situation where it's contested.
I think the best case, then, is 885.23.
Is that the only – are you advancing that's the only way?
I think the way that the statute has to be construed, yes. I don't think that the legislature intended a stillborn paternity or a putative father to determine the paternity of a stillborn infant under the paternity statutes. I think that it's, like I said, it's something that fell through the cracks that the legislature never intended. And as their want, I do know that they just revised the paternity statutes again after this Court of Appeals decision came out, changing language. This seems to be a very active statute. I don't think there was any substantive changes that affect the provisions here, but there were wholesale revisions that go into effect, I believe, January of 2007 on new actions. But those came out shortly after this Court of Appeals decision was released. So I think that if the legislature does intend that stillborn's paternity can be determined in a case like this or in any other case where it's disputed, that they should change and be very specific. What do they mean by child? Now, the justices have brought up, they're probably not going to want to do that because it raises these other issues that will suddenly, what does it mean if we're defining a child to mean a viable stillborn under this statute? Maybe they just include...
It was a different statute, but in Petrisky, we said you can bring, but it isn't a legal question under 885.23 whether or not a viable fetus is a child. We have declared in Petrisky that a cause of action may be maintained for wrongful death of a viable fetus. Legislature doesn't have to say that. We've got case law and we have legislative law, and that doesn't seem to be inconsistent. I mean, they haven't enacted legislation to change that development of the common law.
Well, I think that what you defined as a person, it wasn't a child, whether there's a functional distinction,
I don't know.
I think that was a case of looking at what the wrongful death statute was meant to provide, and to looking at, yes, we're going to recognize that parents have damages, if you will, from the wrongful death of even a viable fetus. I noticed the court didn't go so far as to say non-viable fetus yet. I mean,
no,
there is
fact,
the court's
specifically
line drawn.
Didn't.
Right. I don't know, and I think it was one of the issues that I think the Court of Appeals raised in its original certification to the Supreme Court was when it was dealing with the stillbirth issue. Basically, well, if we interpret it one way, does that mean that miscarriages can somehow fall under this? It doesn't say viable. Are we going to put the limit? Is the court going to put the limit at viable? for something like that. So they obviously had some concerns. I think what they chose to do when cert was denied, they asked for another round of briefing. They were the ones that brought up 88523. It really hadn't been fully developed or addressed in the that I'm aware of, that I could recall in any of the trial court proceedings or actually in the initial round of Court of Appeals briefs. So they were the ones that raised that in the DiBenedetto case.
Just for clarification, I know the statute has been renumbered since Kwaczerski, but is the substance of the statute in relevant part the same, and the statute that I'm referring to, of course, is 885-23. Is that the same as it was in Kwaczerski in relevant part? If you know. If you don't know, that's okay.
That's the wrongful death statute.
That's right. And in Kwaczerski, it was 331 or something, and it's been now renumbered to 89503. I just don't know. I can look it up if you don't know offhand.
I'm not certain if there's been any substantive changes. Again, I tend to think because that's a wrongful death issue, I would argue that that's better preserved for Judge Zappin to rule on, regardless or if it goes back to him. There are a whole host of issues that the court can address there, probably better as a more complete record that is developed in that case than it would be from this court to be sitting here going, we don't know the reason why Judge did it, we don't know. We can give suggestions that 8823 might be the preferred method, or method, but whether that's applicable in that case or whether it can actually go forward is something that really I think has to be left for Judge Zappin to initially rule on, unless the court was going to go down and grab it right now. But then you're going to be having a host of other parties. That was never requested by Shannon for any appeal or for the Supreme Court to grab the case to deal with it. But I do think, in fairness to the other parties, that if this court was going to issue a ruling mandating something on Judge Zappin, that they should have their say on those issues. While primarily paternity may deal with Alicia, she's not a party to that action. There's a question, does she have to be a party to that action? There is a Court of Appeals case, I believe the Joshua AAE case from 1992, that says a mother is a necessary party to a paternity action under 760-745. Whether that would apply under 885-23, I guess, is a question that could be left for Judge Zappin. But that also is a problem that maybe there's a reason why we're in a separate lawsuit here. I just don't think we know, and the court doesn't have a full enough record to develop that issue, I don't think, based on the record as it stands now.
Are there any other questions or comments? Justice Prosser.
Do you think there's any question that sooner or later, some way or the other, paternity is going to be established?
It will all depend on, I would presume, if it goes back to 885-23, Alicia doesn't know, or can't testify, I should say. So we are left probably with genetic testing. That may answer it one way or the other. If genetic testing isn't available, I don't know if it can be established in this case based on some of the other evidentiary problems. But I do think that even if we have evidentiary problems here, and for instance, it goes back to Judge Zappin and he's not allowed to proceed because of evidentiary reasons only, because there just isn't material, those don't raise the constitutional concerns necessarily, because it's an evidentiary problem. It's not a procedural problem where we're foreclosing, treating putative fathers differently from other fathers. And I do think there's case law that suggests that evidentiary problems don't necessarily give rise to equal protection problems if there still would potentially be available if there weren't the evidentiary issues.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Zimmerman, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Justice. I was intrigued by Judge Rogensack's question as to why is Alicia opposing the establishment of paternity. And I believe this is in the record. The wrongful death case was brought against, there were two drivers involved in this motor vehicle accident. One was Alicia and another was, I believe his name was Brett Anderson. They are both represented by American Family, which is the same law firm as Mr. Roman's law firm. So although American Family ostensibly has no interest in this case, they do have an interest in the wrongful death case, which I think is a related case. I think I've made that point. So
are there any limits problems? Does the record reflect that?
Well, I think there are limits. I don't know what they are.
Sure, there are limits.
There are limits.
The question is.
But what happened was.
Alicia, the record reflects it. Do you know that one way or the other?
Does not reflect in the record. There was this covenant to sue, not to sue, which Mr. Roman brought up. And that's my understanding as well. Alicia is judgment proof, and so there's a covenant not to sue. But I believe she was, at least in the complaint, named as a defendant. So just that aside. But it also puzzles me why somebody would oppose genetic testing. What difference does it make to the respondent whether genetic testing is done in the wrongful death action or in the paternity action? The key here is that Shannon is willing to undergo genetic testing. I mean, he wants to prove that he's the father.
But in order to do genetic testing, there may have to be an exhumation. I think there's a statute that deals with the standard that it can't be ordered if the court finds undue hardship. Are you familiar with that at all?
No, I'm not, but...
I may be wrong, but I think that exists.
As a practical matter, if these tissue samples are inadequate, then the genetic testing may not be done. However, that under 885.23, that all that means that there's going to be an adverse inference instruction to the jury. And it's a question of fact then for the jury whether or not if Shannon's the father or Shannon's not the father, based on whatever evidence they are able to introduce. But I think that the key here is that Shannon's entitled to a remedy, and I have no doubt that he will get a remedy. It's just a question of which court. And that's about all I have to say. Thank you very much. It's been a privilege and an honor. The first time that I've been able to argue in front of this court, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you again. And thank you, Mr. Roman.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. And we have no special rules for either first, second, or third appearances. It doesn't mean you win one when you get here or lose one. But you should be... You, as well as Mr. Roman, should be very pleased with the arguments you have presented today in a very difficult case and one separated from another case that the court does not know anything about except what's in the limited record. So that concludes our hearing on 05-AP-0077, Shannon E.T. versus Alicia M.V.M. The students should remain, and anyone else who wishes to remain, and Justice Crooks will be out shortly to talk to you about our procedures. With that, we're in recess until 1:30.